Well, good morning. My name is Ben. If we haven't had the privilege of meeting before, I'm the lead pastor here at CORE. And like Dez said just a few minutes ago, we want you to know how incredibly excited we are that you're here. And over the last week, within my household, I've been flying solo with our two boys as my wife Krista has been leading a team of nine to our care point in Guatemala. And never before in my life, under any other circumstances, have I appreciated more mine and your ability to just simply make it someplace on time. And so we want you to know, whatever your circumstances are, we see you and we're so glad that you've carved out a little bit of your weekend to spend it here with us. You see, whether you're here in person or you're checking us out online, we couldn't be more excited that you're here to join us in the second part of this conversation through the book of Ruth. And if you're here, maybe for the first time during this particular series, and you've been to CORE before, what you're thinking is that this already feels just a little bit different. Because typically at CORE, we work in series that aren't titled directly after one particular book of the Bible. And yet what I want you to know is this, is that even though right now you may be feeling as if this seems just a little bit different at face value, that I believe with all of my heart that as we work through this series over these 6 weeks in our summer months, that this series has the potential to be incredibly relevant and incredibly powerful in every single one of our lives. And here's why. Last week, we set clear expectations for where this series was going. Because if you're anything like me, anytime you sign up for something, sign on for something, you want to know what you're getting yourself into. And we thought last week the best way for us to set clear expectations for what this series was going to look like was to relate it to something we all love and we all enjoy, the movies. And we related it to our favorite movie genres, that maybe some of y'all, you love thriller movies, you love action movies, you love superhero movies, you love comedies, or you love the rom-coms, whatever it is. Those are the movies, the stories that you resonate with most. And as we set clear expectations, what we wanted you to know is that this particular account that we find almost 3,000 years ago in the middle of the Old Testament is a story that wouldn't fall into any of those genres. It is a story that consists of just 85 verses. And of those 85 verses, 55 of them are dialogue. Dialogue primarily done by two females. And what we find within this account, there are no physical miracles that take place. No resurrections, no shootouts, no car chases, none of that stuff. In fact, this particular account seems pretty ordinary. The only thing that we see consistently happening in this account of this one family is the consistency of loss. Them dealing with heartbreak and misfortune. And this is why I believe that these 6 weeks are relevant for every single one of us. Because isn't that what your life feels like most of the time? You don't see a whole lot of physical miracles happening in your story. There aren't a whole lot of dead things that are coming back to life. There are moments scattered all along the way where you don't see God moving and you question whether God is even there. And if you were to be honest, your story feels kind of ordinary. And the only thing you've seen in every season of your life with consistency is loss. The things seem to be dying, the things seem to be changing at every turn, and you're figuring out how to deal with that. And yet, what if we could still find God in the ordinary moments of our lives? The moments that don't have the car chases, the moments that don't have the physical miracles, the moments that don't have the shootouts and the action, the moments that don't have the resurrections in our life. Is it possible for us to still see God when everybody else would say he isn't there? Is it possible for us to still find a way to follow this God in the ordinary moments of our lives? That's what this series is all about. That's why this series has the potential to drive you and I forward to a better future from this day forward. And so last week, we started this journey together by introducing you to a family and the major characters in this account, like I said, some 3,000 years ago. A man named Elimelech, yes, a mouthful, is raising his family alongside of his wife, Naomi, and they have two sons, and ultimately were introduced to two daughters-in-law eventually in the story. But Elimelech is raising his family in the middle of a town called Bethlehem, right smack dab in the middle of a famine that has swept across the entire region and has now left them questioning their future and their livelihood moving forward. And in the midst of this famine, Elimelech gets this brilliant idea that because things are going so poorly, maybe it would be best for me to move my family someplace else where there isn't a famine ravishing the land. And so he decides to pick up his family of four and move them to a country called Moab. And they set out on this 50-mile journey, and I showed you this map last week of the journey and what it looked like around the Dead Sea down to the country of Moab. About 50 miles, and this 50-mile journey would take anywhere from 7 to 10 days on foot, depending upon the pace at which you were traveling, how many young kids you had, how fussy they were on the trip, whether you had the iPads charged or not to keep them moving along. And as they embarked on this trip from Bethlehem down to Moab, here was the issue. God had instructed his people not to move to Moab. And here's why. Because ultimately, the country of Moab was defined by pure evil. All the surrounding regions knew this about Moab. Moab was a tribe of people that was formed from an act of incest. They worshiped one false god by the name of Chemosh. And the primary way in which they worshiped Chemosh was through child sacrifice. Everything about this place was moving in the wrong direction. And here is what God knew. This is the reason why God had given instruction for his people not to move to Moab. Because God fully understood this eternal plight of humanity. Yes, me and you even face this plight right here, right now, today. That when surrounded by the wrong people, we will always ultimately move in the wrong direction. And so God instructed them, don't go to Moab because you're going to be surrounded by the wrong people, and before long you will begin to move in the wrong direction. But Elimelech did what he thought was right in his own eyes. And so he picked up his family and moved them to Moab. And before long, everything was falling apart. Before long, Elimelech had died. And then his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, died as well. This left Naomi, his wife, alone with only her two daughters-in-law. And after being in the wrong place and their life moving in the wrong direction, when everything was falling apart, Naomi had a decision to make, and this is the decision that she made. This was the conclusion that she came to that ultimately changed everything. That if she wanted to get to the right place, she had to leave the wrong one. And the same is true for you and I. That if you want to get to the right place, ultimately you'll have to decide to leave the wrong one. And so they picked up all of their belongings and they began their trek back to Bethlehem. But upon beginning this journey, Naomi makes this gracious offer to her two daughter-in-laws. You see, if you know nothing about ancient Jewish culture, as a young woman, when you were married to a man, there was a transaction that would take place that ultimately you were being bought or purchased into that man's family. And so once you were married to a man, you were no longer part of your old family, no longer connected to your parents. You officially became connected to his family. And even if your husband died, you were still a part of that family. Naomi knew this. And yet as they began their trek back, she made this gracious offer to her daughters-in-law. I'm releasing you. Go back to your parents. Go back to your childhood home. And this was her prayer for her two daughters-in-law. My prayer is that you find husbands and you find a prosperous future. Can you believe that? This was all Naomi had. She had nothing to her name, no home, no hope, only two daughters-in-law, and her gracious offer was, you can leave me as well. Go back and find a better life. One of her daughters-in-law took her up on her offer, but her other, Ruth, made a different decision. This was how she responded that totally changed the story. In Ruth chapter 1, verse 16, this was Ruth's response to her mother-in-law's offer. But Ruth replied, "Don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." You see, Naomi's courage to turn around, to change her life, ultimately unlocked the freedom for someone else in her life to turn their lives around as well. This is one of my favorite passages in the entire book of Ruth. This moment where Ruth doesn't even fully know this God that Naomi worships, and yet she sees the turnaround, the courage that Naomi has, and she says, "You've got something different, and whatever it is that you've got, I want that. And so whoever your God is, I'm following him." This one decision by Naomi altered somebody else's life for her to leave the wrong place and to head back towards the right one. But today, we turn the page to chapter 2 to discover some relational relevance in the ordinary moments of our lives. You see, here's the thought we all ponder, or at least we should, at some point in our lives. If our relationships matter, and the most important relationship on this earth with another human being that we will encounter will be with the person that we marry, then how do we get things right from the very beginning and ensure that we choose the right person to be married to? And the reason why we avoid that question or we struggle with answering that question is because what we all know is the answer to that question is complicated. Am I right? Answering that question is hard. Oftentimes can be downright confusing. We find ourselves wondering, what do we do and where do we go? Like, do we simply walk around in our lives, and if we're looking for the right person to help move us in the right direction for that very important relationship, do we walk in and approach people with lines, dare I say, pickup lines like this? Is it hot in here, or is that just the Holy Spirit burning inside of you? You must be a Bible verse because I want to memorize you. We walk into settings like this and we just look for people who are raising their hands during worship and don't have a ring on it. What do we do? How do we ensure that we start this right and find the person that's going to help us move in the right directions for the biggest relationship of our lives? And while we think that that's confusing and hard, the reality is that the culture and the world around us, while they seem to be moving in a completely different direction relationally than what we're called to, for those of us who walked into this room claiming to be Jesus followers, what we can also see as we look out into the world is that they're struggling to answer that question as well. And in this worldwide struggle to answer the question of how we get this one relationship right, what we seem to be finding is that this thing called marriage is becoming less and less important. You see, here's some of what the stats tell us. Check this out. Over the last 5 decades, marriage rates have decreased by over 60%. Over the last 5 decades, with each passing generation, us as humanity continues to decide that maybe this thing called marriage just isn't worth it. On top of that, there is this reality that for men under the age of 30, 63% of men under the age of 30 are choosing to be single. 63% of men under 30 are choosing to be single. And on top of that, 77% of millennials claim that they would rather live with their partner before they decide to marry them. You see, this is the plight that we all find ourselves up against. This is the struggle that we see as we look out into our world and our culture when deciding what to do and what direction to go. And yet, as complicated as this whole thing is, here's what I believe with all of my heart. Deep inside of every single one of us, there is this desire to share life with someone special. We were designed for community. And we have this craving inside of us to find that partner in crime for our lives. But when we look at most relationships and marriage, it's pretty obvious, right, that something isn't working. And yet here's the crazy part. We continue to operate under the definition of insanity. We continue to do what the rest of culture is doing around us, and we expect different results. But here's the real truth. If we simply do what everyone else is doing, we'll get what everyone else is getting. If all we do is choose to do what everybody else in our world is doing, we'll get the same thing that everybody else is getting. Broken relationships, divorce at rates over 50%. It's the reason why, y'all, divorce rates within a place like this are no different than the world and the culture around us. They are the exact same percentages. Because if we just do what everyone else is doing within our relationships, we'll get what everyone else is getting. But if we want something different, we have to take a different approach. And what we'll come to find out, and here's where I believe with all of my heart, I'm giving you freedom to lean back in. Because some of you are sitting here and you're like, Ben, all right, we're going to talk about dating relationships and finding the right person, and I'm already married, or I've lost someone recently, or I've been divorced, and I don't know that this really applies to me. You see, here's what I believe with all of my heart. That what we're going to talk about today in this different approach applies to the relationships of our lives, but also applies to our life if we are in marriage and some shifts that we can make. It applies to the relationships of our lives sometimes outside of our marriages, with relationships that we have with friends. These are some relational tactics that we can use to get healthier. But if you aren't married in this room, man, I want to challenge you. You have got to lean in for the next 20 minutes. Because what I believe with all of my heart is that this is going to set you up in the same way that we're going to come to discover that this set up Ruth for something different moving forward in her future. You see, as we turn this page, chapter 1 was filled with nothing but loss and heartbreak in the lives of one family. And yet today we turn this page from a story that was filled with things like famine, and three deaths, daughters-in-law walking away from their family, moving to a completely new place. But we turn the page with this hope, the same hope that we're going to see begin to stream or sort of spill out from this story, that we serve a God who is the author of turning the page, of being able to bring out something incredible from something that was once hurtful and heartbreaking. That whatever struggle and heartbreak you're up against, there is hope that turning the page is possible and something new and better can be experienced. As we turn the page, Naomi and Ruth arrive back in Bethlehem. And as they arrive back in Bethlehem, they find themselves with the dilemma that we all assume they would have. They have nothing to their name. They're broke. Searching for how to make ends meet and how to, frankly, survive day to day with nothing to their name. And yet, with nothing to their name and trying to figure out how they're going to survive, Ruth makes a decision. And upon making this decision, she stumbles upon a new character, someone that we're introduced to in Ruth chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Here is who we're introduced to. Now there was a wealthy and influential man in Bethlehem named Boaz. Right off the bat, in verse 1, we're introduced to this man named Boaz. And what we find is that this man is described as a wealthy and influential man. Some translations would replace the word influential with this term, a man of standing. And yet, while these two words seem interchangeable within different translations, here's what's so incredible. That those two words, influential and man of standing, are actually two things that go hand in hand in ancient Jewish culture. You see, in ancient Jewish culture, being a wealthy person did not automatically give you influence. That's typically what we think of in our 21st century first world perspective, right? That if you're wealthy, you ultimately have influence. But that's not how it worked in ancient Jewish culture. The way in which you had influence in ancient Jewish culture was by being a man of character and integrity. That's how you gained influence in culture. You see, essentially what's being laid out for us here is this, is that Boaz became a person of influence within his city, within his culture, because he came about his wealth in the right way. He made his money not by cutting corners, not by cheating others, by being a person of integrity, by being a man of standing. And right off the bat, you can see where we're going, right? That they're introducing us to this character and laying out these traits of this man, essentially saying, in your life, you are looking for a Boaz. This is the kind of person that you should be shooting for. Now catch my verbiage here. You in your life are looking for a Boaz. Not a lazy as. Not a dumb as. A Boaz. No emails. I said as with a Z. This is what we're looking for in our lives, and this is what we should be shooting for. And now Ruth goes to work on her plan to just simply survive. One day, Ruth, the Moabite, said to Naomi, "Let me go out into the harvest fields to pick up stalks of grain left behind by anyone who is kind enough to let me do it." Naomi replied, "All right, my daughter, go ahead." So Ruth went out to gather grain behind the harvesters. Now, in ancient Jewish culture, grain harvesting was the original soup kitchen. Here's how it worked. For those who were wealthy and owned fields, at harvest time, they were given the option to invite a homeless or a poor, someone struggling to survive, to come into their fields and follow the harvesters around. As the harvesters would make their way through the field, any heads of grain that they would drop as they were harvesting it, it was the homeless person's opportunity for them to collect anything that had been dropped and left behind. Ultimately, for anyone who was generous, they would invite one, maybe two at the most, and this was sort of their act of love and service to their community. And so this is how it would work. You would go and hopefully find a generous person if you were struggling to make ends meet who would allow you to walk through their fields at harvest time and collect any of the leftovers, anything that had been dropped by all the harvesters in the field. And so this is the idea that Ruth got. We have absolutely nothing. And so maybe there will be a generous person out there who will allow me to just pick up the scraps so that we will have something to eat. So Ruth goes out, and the first field she comes to, by seemingly coincidence, is this. And as it happened, she found herself working in a field that belonged to Boaz. I love this terminology. As it happened. You see, there are so many times in our lives where it is so easy for us to confuse God's hand with coincidence. We may not see the supernatural miracles, But when we look close enough, we can see the supernatural providence of God at work in our lives. And here's what the providence of God is, y'all. I know that that's a big word, Ben, and I'm not sure what that means. And it's one of those words that kind of makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. You see, the providence of God is simply this. Check out this definition. It is when God uses natural circumstances to bring about his supernatural plans. When God uses what seems like coincidence or just natural happenstance in our lives to bring about his supernatural plan in our present for our future. See, y'all, here are three things that I believe with all of my heart. The first is this. When we do the right things in the right way in one area of our lives, God's hand and his providence begins to move in other areas of our lives as well. Even when we don't see it, even when we don't feel it. I believe it with all of my heart that when we make the tough choice to do the right things in the right way in one part of our life, that God's hand begins moving in other parts of our lives too. Secondly, I believe with all of my heart that God cares about what you care about. You see, this is one of the things that absolutely blows my mind. That we have a God who is big enough to hold the world in his hands, and yet a God who is small enough to care about what I'm walking through, to care about what breaks my heart. And yet, here's what we also have to realize, y'all. Even though God cares about what you care about, we also must know that God knows better about that thing in your life that you care about than what you do. And what that means is this. Even though you care about it, the way in which you want that particular thing to turn out may not be the way in which God is planning for that thing to turn out. Because God knows better and sees farther than what you and I do. And just because your prayers don't get answered in the areas of your life that you care about the way you want them to, doesn't negate the fact that God still cares. And third, I believe with all of my heart that prayer moves the heart of God. Don't ask me to explain it, y'all. It is one of those unexplainable things of faith that I cherish and cling to that I'll never be able to explain. But I believe with all of my heart that prayer moves the heart of God. And so if God cares about the things that you care about, and prayer has the ability to move his heart, then maybe the question that we should be asking is this. Do you pray with diligence about the things you care for? Do you pray with perseverance about the things you care about? Do you pray about the things you care about at all? Because if God cares about the things you care about and prayer has the power to move God's heart, shouldn't we be praying about the things we care about, the things that are important in our lives? If you're not married, do you pray about your future spouse? If your kids aren't married, do you pray about their future spouse? If you have kids, do you pray for their future friends? I've told you the story of our oldest. Krista and I have found ourselves already at 7 years old. Our oldest is the people pleaser. He wants to be accepted. He wants to be liked. And to do so, he'll do whatever anybody asks him to do. And our hearts have shifted over the course of the last couple months. I'm like, God, just put the right people in his life. Bring about the right friends who he's capable of listening to and who are going to help pull him in the right direction. Do you pray for the future friends of your kids? If you are married, do you pray for the individual future of your spouse? Do you pray for the future of your marriage and the health of where your marriage is headed? Do you pray for your spouse's faith, whether or not they're taking steps forward in their relationships with God? See, these are questions that if we want to find the right people in our lives, are we praying about the things that are important? Back to the story. In the aftermath of the heartbreak, God begins to move in subtle ways on Ruth's behalf. She's in Boaz's field collecting grain that's been dropped on the ground behind the harvesters. And then for the first time, she meets Boaz. This is how the interaction takes place. While she, meaning Ruth, was there in the field, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you," he said. "The Lord bless you," the harvesters replied. You see, right off the bat, in her first interaction with Boaz, she gets a glimpse into Boaz's heart. Here's something to think about. People tend to talk about first what they care about most. And if you're someone who's dating or would like to be dating at some point, you're someone who's divorced, and at some point in your future, you may get back into the game. Here's a question to consider and ponder. Did they talk about their faith on the first date? Second date? Third date? Because people tend to talk about first what they care about most. And this, in those first few dates, could be a pretty clear indication of the heart of the person you're choosing to get involved with. What I love here, side note, message within the message. Some of y'all are like, "I'm not in the dating game, not going to be in the dating game. I'm looking for something to grab onto here, Ben." This is what I absolutely love about Boaz. When he approaches his workers in the field, what does he say? He immediately says to them, "The Lord be with you." You see, what I love about Boaz is that he looks at his workplace, his job, as if it's full-time ministry. You don't have to be in full-time ministry to be in full-time ministry, y'all. Every single day that you walk into your workplace, whatever that workplace is, you have an opportunity to love people like Jesus. You have an opportunity, if you are a Jesus follower, to be in full-time ministry. Your workplace is your ministry. Your home is your ministry. Your neighborhood is your ministry. And right off the bat, Boaz puts that out here. My job, my work is my ministry. I want people to see God through me. But in this very moment when she encounters Boaz for the very first time, Ruth had a choice. She could have allowed her past to deter her from God's plan for her future. You see, here's how Ruth could have thought. My past is full of darkness. If I tell this guy that I was a Moabite woman, he's immediately going to know. I spent the entirety of my life worshiping this false god named Chemosh. My past is full of dark things, and I couldn't possibly be worthy of God's best in my future. Y'all, don't let your past deter you from God's plan for your future. He has something incredible for you, regardless of what you think your past says about you. And then, as Boaz spots this unfamiliar woman in the field, he asks his foreman a question. Then Boaz asked his foreman, "Who is that young woman over there? Who does she belong to?" And the foreman replied, "She is the young woman from Moab who came back with Naomi. She asked me this morning if she could gather grain behind the harvesters. She has been hard at work ever since." You see, right off the bat, we get four subtle character traits that define who Ruth is, and ultimately begin to define for those of you men in the room what you should be looking for in a woman. These are the four traits that we see come out from the words of the foreman. The first is this, is that this woman, Ruth, is faithful to God. Did you catch the very first sentence that the foreman made? Here is this woman who was once from Moab, but she traveled back here to Bethlehem. This was an indication that she had given up her faith and was now putting her faith in God. She was no longer worshiping Chemosh in Moab, but had traveled back to Bethlehem to worship the God of the universe. In this moment, it was being made clear that she's faithful to God. Secondly, that she's loyal to her loved ones. That she doesn't talk poorly behind their back. She doesn't stab them in the back. She doesn't walk away when things get hard. This is the woman who traveled back from Moab with Naomi. Even though she didn't have to, she stuck by her side. Even though she didn't have to, she is one that has proven her loyalty within the context of relationship with loved ones. Third, she's a hard worker. She has been out here in the heat of the Middle Eastern day, toiling away, trying to pick up the scraps off the ground for her and her mother-in-law to have something to eat. And she's been at it all day long. And then fourth, this is a woman who honors God morally. Now, this one is really subtle, and you have to understand context to see why this is a character trait that comes out in this conversation. When he identifies that this woman is a widow who's traveled back with mother-in-law from Moab to Bethlehem, and now she's been out in the field working all day to try to provide for her family, this is what immediately was tipped off. In ancient Jewish and Roman culture, when you became a widow, you were not capable of going out and finding a job as a woman in that culture and context. And so in order for you to make ends meet, when you did not have a man providing for you some 3,000 years ago, about the only option that you had was prostitution. That's how you could make ends meet within that culture as a widow. And here, Ruth made the choice. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to figure something else out. And she honored God morally with her decision. You see, this isn't, guys, just something that you should be looking for in a woman. Women, this is also an incredible litmus test of what you should be striving for. If you're still in the dating game, still unmarried, be the person that the person you're looking for is looking for. If you are married and you want your relationship to go to another level, you want your marriage to improve by 1%, 2%. It isn't just about the other person. There's also a question of what can I do individually to improve my relationship. This is the litmus test that we can send ourselves through. Am I doing this for the sake of my relationships, for the sake of my marriage? But then the script is flipped. We get a glimpse into Boaz. In verse 8, Boaz went over and said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter, stay right here with us when you gather grain. Don't go to any other fields. I have warned the young men not to treat you roughly. And when you are thirsty, help yourself to the water they have drawn from the well." And then in verse 12, he finishes the conversation like this. "May the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge, reward you fully for what you have done." You see, this last part of the conversation isn't really conversation at all. What Boaz is doing is this. He's offering a prayer for Ruth. A prayer on Ruth's behalf. You see, within this short conversation, we see four traits come out in Boaz that as a woman you should be looking for in a man. And these are those. First, Boaz honors her. You see, wealthy men did not talk to homeless, poor people, let alone homeless, poor women in that context. And yet he honors her by walking up to her and addressing her, looking her in the eye and talking to her directly. In that moment, he honors her by giving her value and worth and respect in this moment. And then, you see, this is incredible. He protects her. I've already talked to all of the men in the field, and I've warned them. You better treat her kindly. I better not catch word that you've been harsh to this woman who is working away in our field. And then he provides for her. Whenever you get thirsty, take what you need. This was unheard of because she wasn't even a worker. But he was offering the resources that he had provided for his workers now to her, to provide for her in her moments of need. And then lastly, he prays for her. He prays for her. Guys, do you pray for your spouse? Maybe a better question. Have you gotten in the habit of praying together? Do you ever pray with each other within the context of your relationships? Guys, the same challenge I offer to you. Be the person you're looking for is looking for. This is your litmus test within the context of your relationships with someone of the opposite sex or with your wife. If these things aren't happening within that relationship or within your marriage, then the question we should ask is, what do I need to change to start to make these things happen for that other person, to serve them and love them well? You see, chapter 1 was all about loss and heartache. But towards the end of chapter 2, this is the goodness of God and how we see him capable of turning the page and flipping the script in our life. In verse 14, this is ultimately how the interaction concludes. At mealtime, Boaz called to her, "Come over here and help yourself to some food." So she sat with his harvesters, and Boaz gave her some roasted grain to eat. She ate all she wanted and still had some left over. We have a God who's in the business of turning the page in our lives, in our stories, in our relationships. In chapter 1, Ruth had nothing. She wasn't sure if she was going to be able to survive. She was hungry and poor and homeless. And by the end of chapter 2, she had a God who had fed her all she had wanted, and she had some left over. See, whatever circumstances you're up against, whatever your life looks like, whatever past relationships you've been in, come through, failed at, whatever your present relationships look like, we have a God who's in the business of helping us turn the page. And whatever stage of relationships you're in, today is your opportunity to turn that page and to do things differently, to make the determination, I don't want what everyone else has, and so I'm going to stop doing what everyone else does. I want something better. I want something different. We have a God who loves us enough in the ordinary of our lives to give us instruction to find his love and to find a better way forward. Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, God, we thank you for this day. We thank you that you have created us for relationship, to do life with other people. We thank you that you've given us the opportunity to do this thing called marriage, to have a partner in crime, to help us sift through the difficulties of life. And yet, God, when it comes to our relationships, it's so easy for us to just do what we see everybody else doing, whether that's in friendships, whether that's in dating, whether that's in marriage, whether that's with our coworkers or our neighbors. And yet we turn around and wonder why we're getting what everybody else is getting. So God, today, I pray that you give us courage to take a different approach. To not just look for something different, but to also strive to be something different. To be the person that the person you're looking for is looking for. God, help us to love and serve the people in our lives, just like Boaz did. It's in your name that we pray. This morning, with all eyes still closed, with all heads still bowed, maybe the light bulb inside of you that's gone off this morning is this. Is that I need a God who loves me enough to help me turn the page. Not just in my relationships, maybe it's some other facet of your life where it feels like that facet of your life has been defined by loss and heartbreak. And you're not sure if there's any hope, you're not sure if there's any moving forward. And yet today, to hear the hope of a God who loves you enough to have something better in chapter 2 than what you've walked through in chapter 1 is the God that you want to attach yourself to, is a God that is worth following in your life. And if that's you this morning, it all begins by just simply saying yes to him. But Ben, I don't know how to do that. I don't know where to start. What am I supposed to pray to say yes to him? If that's you, if you have the courage to take that step back towards God today, it's as simple as just repeating these words, this prayer, in your own head, in your own heart, right here, right now, where you sit. You can repeat this. Heavenly Father, thank you for loving me. Thank you for caring about what I care about. Thank you for sending your son to wipe away the blemishes of my past. Because of how much you love me and are for me, today, I'm saying yes to you. Today, I'm saying I need you, and I'm inviting you into my life. Please help me turn the page. It's in your name that I pray. Amen.